The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Until 1:30, I know many of you have to leave for class at 1, so feel free to do that. But those of you who'd like to stay and ask more questions, Jesse was generous enough to stay until 1:30. So thank you. With that, I'll turn it over.
Well, thank you for your kind introduction and, more importantly, for the invitation to speak here in this series. It's a significant honor for me, and thank you, Kathleen, for supporting it as well.
And thank you. Sorry, but NASA Kathleen Duskin, who is the executive director of the National Institute of Military Justice, whose office recently came to the law school, is actually co-sponsoring this event. And Kathleen is here as well, so please answer questions if there are any.
Let me first off, I want to say that I encourage you to ask me questions. I don't mind if you interrupt me unless you're my brother, who I just noticed sitting in the audience. So you're not allowed to ask me any questions about when we grew up. Okay? And since I know you don't know much about this, I'm not too worried. But nor can your co-counsel. I just noticed. I'd like this to be somewhat informal. Let me tell you what I want to talk about for you today. I met Susan at a conference in New York City where I was asked to participate on a panel that addressed the question of whether or not the law of armed conflict or international humanitarian law was sufficient to address the related to the global war on terror, or whether human rights law was an essential component in that equation. And what I want to do first is to give you my thesis on why I think the law of war or the law of armed conflict can be sufficient to address the challenge of what we loosely call the global war on terror. Now, let me start with a qualifier. This term, global war on terror, could itself be a 2 or 3 hour discussion. Is it really a war? Is it really an armed conflict? I'm going to proceed with the premise that the kind of hyperbolic term GWAT is really referring to the military component of the broader effort of the United States to leverage its diplomatic, informational, military, and economic resources to defeat what it perceives as the threat of transnational terrorism directed at the United States. So, when I speak of the global war on terror, I'm speaking of the armed component of that struggle being conducted by the United States in Afghanistan, in Iraq, and in other places of the world, and potentially in other places of the world. Another qualifier in this use of the word GWAT. My focus is going to be on the use in Belarus. I believe that the armed component of the global war on terror has once again highlighted for all practitioners, experts, government officials, and anybody interested in the subject of the regulation of military conflict, that it is really essential to draw a bright distinction between the use ad bellum and the use in bellum. The reason I say that is because part of my thesis is my personal belief that it is not unlikely that in the future the United States will direct its military forces to conduct combat-type operations against transnational terrorist entities in a location where there might not be the consent of the state for conducting the operation. In other words, that the United States may make a decision that in order to attack a certain target or defeat certain enemies, it's necessary to violate the use ad bellum. But that does not mean that the use in bellum somehow goes away, or the obligations derived from the use in bellum go away. And so my focus is going to be specifically on the norms that are essential to regulate the conduct of combat-type military operations directed against transnational terrorism. And that really kind of crystallizes the issue of whether or not the law of armed conflict is sufficient to address those issues, or whether there needs to be more application or applicability or acknowledged applicability by the United States of international human rights. That'll be the first part of my discussion. towards the end, I'm going to shift gears and I'm going to talk to you about an article that I'm working on that proposes a new, what we might call test or criteria for drawing the line between the legal and or the permissible and the impermissible activities of civilians who augment military forces on the battlefield, authorized by the state to be on the battlefield, performing all sorts of functions. And that'll be the second part. But let me begin with kind of a piece that Susan asked me to address initially, which is why I think the law of armed conflict is sufficient to address these issues. And in fact, I would say I think it's essential that the law of armed conflict be acknowledged as applicable to the military component of the war on terror. It's essential because most of us, when there's debate on whether or not the law of armed conflict should apply to this struggle, and we start to kind of unpack some of the administration's decisions related to the applicability of certain norms of the law of armed conflict, the principal concern that I perceive, which I think is legitimate, is the perception that since 9/11, the United States has been involved in a practice of what you might call cherry picking. So you have these norms that are hanging from the branches of the law of armed conflict, and those that are useful are pulled out or pulled off the tree, like the doctrine of military necessity, or principles related to targeting of individuals who pose a threat to the United States and their forces. But then when it comes to the humane treatment route, the United States backs away and says this concept is different. These individuals don't apply to these protections. And therefore, if they are entitled to humane treatment, it is only as a matter of policy. And by the way, even if it is a matter of policy, we will apply humane treatment to these individuals so long as it's consistent with the doctrine or principle of military necessity. And for people like my friend Lieutenant Colonel Sam Mubangu and I, when we read that portion of that now kind of infamous memo, that's the thing that shocked us, because it was inconsistent with everything we had ever been taught about the balance between the principle of humanity and the principle of necessity. Because what we had been taught was that those two principles, as core principles of the law of armed conflict, had evolved kind of collectively, and a balance has been struck between them, which is reflected in the Army's field manual on the law of war, which states that the doctrine of military necessity is a doctrine that authorizes a military commander to take those measures that are necessary for securing the prompt submission of an enemy, comma, that are not otherwise prohibited by international law. In other words, military necessity has already factored in the limiting effect of the principle of humanity and the obligation of treating people humanely. It is not an override to it. That theory, what we know, was rejected by the International Military Tribunal in Nuremberg when German defendants proffered their doctrine of what they called Kriegsraison, which was the doctrine that says, in war, the logic of war ultimately trumps all other rules. An absolute doctrine of military necessity had been long ago rejected, since 1957, when the Field Manual 2710 was written. It's been kind of an article of faith that military necessity is not an unlimited source of art. And so it was perception that this balance was being distorted that for me personally seems so troubling. And I think it's that distortion itself is one of the reasons why many proponents of the humanitarian protections that all individuals who are victims of war should be entitled to today assert that it's essential to inject international human rights norms into this decision-making process. Because otherwise, what protects them? A policy. And so one of my beliefs is that the law of armed conflict can be effective to deal with these issues only if it's applied consistently with its historically understood meaning, which means that the principle of humanity is non-derogative. It's not subject to being pierced by an argument of necessity. And we've seen this over and over again. I mean, yesterday, Professor Tatiel argued on behalf of his client, Mr. Hamdan, down in Italy. And if you look at the whole process of the military commission and some of the arguments that have been left against it by Mr. Hamdan's lawyers, the response that comes back over and over again is, this is a different war. The president needs to be able to do what he needs to do to protect the nation. But the law of armed conflict presumes that states engaged in conflict are going to need to do what they need to do to protect their interests. And yet, through history, military leaders have been instrumental in drawing a line that is today reflected in this doctrine of humanity, or this principle of humanity. Why? Because they recognize that historically, when you treat people inhumanely, when you don't draw a line, a limit on the conduct of warriors on the battlefield, the consequence on a macro scale is far more detrimental than the micro scale benefit that might be derived. Now, the other aspect of this issue that I think is interesting is that I believe that the GWAT generally has exposed what I think is the danger of this myopic focus on the Article 2, Article 3 construct for determining when the law of armed conflict applies to any given situation. Now, when I taught at the JAG school, I mean, I was a true believer. My students would come in on their introduction to the law of war, and we start with, when does the law of war apply to a certain situation? Well, there are two possibilities. Either you satisfy the criteria of Article 2 of the four Geneva Conventions, triggering an international armed conflict, or you satisfy the criteria of Article 3 of the Geneva Conventions, and you have a non-international armed conflict takes place within the territory of a high contracting party. And so then we get to a situation where we're engaged in a armed conflict that has kind of global reach, if you will, against a non-state entity that's not operating in the territory of the United States. It's operating all over the world, and yet has the type of organization, command structure, and capability traditionally associated with the type of armed component that you would have to respond to with your armed forces. And when I first got to DOD, I kind of try and figure out, well, where does this thing fall? I personally had a bit of an epiphany that was made, essentially, maybe that's not the only way these rules apply. Maybe Article 2 and Article 3 are what they say they are, the triggering criteria for the conventions themselves. But what happens when the armed forces are called upon to engage in combat-type activities in a situation that technically doesn't satisfy one of those two articles? Are we suggesting that it's a lawless environment? That they're not guided by any principles of the law of war or the law of armed conflict? I think the answer has to be no. And I think history tells us that the answer is no. We know that historically, armed forces, prior to kind of the recognition that the concept of war was being politically manipulated in the post-World War I era, leading into World War II, up until that point, it was almost an ipso facto understanding that when you put on your rucksack, you picked up your rifle, and you put ammo in your rifle, and you went to the field to fight an enemy, the rules applied. Now, of course, the nature of the rules was not evolved over time, but the basic notion of the basic concept that the armed forces were entitled to do what needs to be done to achieve the mission, the doctrine of military necessity, and that individuals who were victims of the conflict were to be treated with humanity, was an ipso facto concept. And at that conference, I gave a hypothetical. I said, imagine there is a highly organized, dangerous, non-state entity operating outside the territory of the United States. This entity has the capability to strike the United States pretty much with impunity and has done so on several occasions. It is perceived by the nation to be a significant risk. It's operating in what you might call a failed state, maybe not, a state that's experiencing tremendous internal instability. As a result, it's unlikely that state would grant the United States authority to send in some type of punitive expedition to address this threat, and certainly the state is incapable of dealing with it on its own. So the United States makes the decision that it will send its armed forces to conduct a military operation in the territory of the southern state in order to defeat this threat. And when I speak in those terms, logically we kind of think, okay, Afghanistan, you've got Al-Qaeda training bases, you have kind of a failed state. At least we know the Taliban will not respond to that threat on our behalf. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about General Pershing's punitive expedition against Pancho Villa in Mexico prior to World War I. Now, why do I use that hypothetical? Because I seriously doubt that when those troops were getting ready to cross the border, there was a big debate over whether are we in an internal or an international armed conflict. Because we need to know, because if we're not either of them, those are just have no tools. And it's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but I use it to illustrate the point that I believe that underlying the credence of the law of armed conflict is a core of basic principles that apply to any armed conflict. And when I use the word armed conflict, I do think that today's commentary on Common Article 3 gives us a good criteria to determine when the reaction of a state crosses the threshold from law enforcement and is now in the threshold of armed conflict. Now, of course, McKay was talking about addressing an internal threat. But if you think about the context of the drafting of the 49 Convention, that was the principal issue of concern. The concern that evolved out of the Spanish Civil War, the Chinese Civil War, the Russian Civil War, was that the historical expectation that the professionalism of an armed force would result in this ipso facto self-regulating dynamic whenever they conducted what we know to be conflict had failed. In Spain, in 3 years, which is became a sideshow to the Second World War, but in 3 years in Spain, the nationalist forces, which was regular army of Spain, regular armed forces, they killed approximately 250,000 enemy combatants, Republican forces, militias, Lincoln Battalion, whatever they were composed of. They also killed approximately 250,000 civilians and prisoners of war. They would go through town and rip the shirts off the men to see if there was a bruise on their arm, because that's how they knew that they had been firing weapons, and they would be summarily executed. This was the context of the 49 Convention in Common Article 3. Why would they have been considering the situation that we're in today in drafting Common Article 3? And so I believe that the theory that Common Article 3 or the principles reflected in Common Article 3 are inapplicable because Al-Qaeda is not operating in the territory of the United States. And this is the point. I think what Common Article 3 was telling the world and what the participants in the drafting conference were acknowledging was that when you are outside the scope of a traditionally defined conflict, it doesn't release armed forces from their obligation to comply with these basic principles, these basic norms of the law of armed conflict. So my theory is that the law of armed conflict requires armed forces of a state to comply with the principles of humanity, distinction, proportionality, and I believe grants them powers derived from the principle of military necessity. Whenever they engage in operations that cross the threshold from what might be considered law enforcement activities and are applying combat power along traditional modalities of military operations. Now that's a blurry line as well, and I know. But Piquet gave us a pretty simple criteria. He said, you can look at all these different factors and decide when the situation the government responding to has crossed the threshold from civil disobedience to insurgency. But there's usually a pretty telling. Look who the government is responding. When the United States calls out the 82nd Airborne Division, the 1st Marine Expeditionary Force, and an expeditionary airplane to engage an enemy, that's not wrong, in my opinion. That's armed conflict. And I think it's essential that the United States acknowledge that any time those type of activities occur, these basic principles are invoked. Whether or not additional layers of regulation are invoked because you satisfy Common Article 2 or Common Article 3 remains a significant issue. But just because you don't trigger those provisions doesn't mean you're released from the obligation to comply with the basic norms. Now, my perspective on why this is essential is maybe a little bit different than many other proponents of the non-derogable nature of humane treatment and the principle of distinction and proportionality. Most advocates of such a view are rightly concerned with the victims of war, the subjects or the objects of armed conflict, the detainees, the prisoners of war, the civilians who suffer collateral damage. But I believe there's an equally significant category of potential victims of war, and that's the armed forces that are called upon to engage in conflict. What history teaches us is that war is about as ugly a business as we can call upon citizens of the nation to participate in. You're asking young men and women, sometimes not so young, sorry, young men and women to participate in an inherently immoral activity. On behalf of the nation, they're going to kill, they're going to maim, they're going to destroy private property, they're going to deprive people of their liberty. It's ugly. Okay? And why the law, why do I believe these basic principles are really indelible whenever armed forces are called upon to participate in these activities? Because I think that they emerge from a recognition by military leaders that if you don't place limits on that brutality, then you don't have, you deprive the soldier, the service member, of the ability to morally reconcile the conduct with their basic sense of morality. This was a point that was emphasized by Telford Taylor in his book on Vietnam, An American Tragedy. And it's one that I read when I was at the JAG school. And this quote always seems so profound to me because it was the real, in my opinion, the true grundnorm of law of armed conflict. Some people say it's reciprocity. But then you have critics saying, well, we can't, reciprocity doesn't matter without this. Because no matter how well we treat their civilians, their prisoners, they're going to murder our people when they cut their heads off. So reciprocity doesn't work. Some people say it's the preservation of international goodwill. But then you have the problem of proponents of an unlimited kind of source of authority in battle saying, well, you know what, that's a sovereign policy decision. If the president is not too worried about engendering goodwill, so be it. He has to make the judgment. My concern is for the servants of the nation. And I'll read you what Telford Taylor wrote. Another, and to my mind, even more important basis of the laws of war is that they are necessary to diminish the corrosive effect of mortal combat on the participants. War does not confer a license to kill for personal reasons, to gratify perverse impulses, or to put out of the way anyone who appears obnoxious, or to whose welfare the soldier is indifferent. War is not a license at all, but an obligation to kill for reasons of state. It does not countenance the infliction of suffering for its own sake or revenge. And for me, that was my epiphany on why the law of war matters. Because what it does is it helps the soldier maintain a line between conducting these activities because you have to, as opposed to personal vendetta, revenge, whatever the case may be. That's the great tradition of American armed forces. That is the great tradition. The image of the American soldier rendering aid to a prisoner of war who moments earlier would have been the object of destructive attack. That's the tradition. And I think that's the tradition that's been compromised by this suggestion that this new war requires a new paradigm of authority. I don't think it does. The balance of work historically. I don't think we're in any greater threat than we were when the nation was divided in 1861 and Francis Lieber wrote what you all know is that amazing and great Lieber poem. Go back and read it. Francis Lieber had an article. Torture is not permitted to obtain information from your captors. 1862. Okay? So from my perspective, this basic principle notion that the basic principles of the law of war are really indelible. And you can pigeonhole that under a number of international legal theories, that they're use token norms, that are non-terrible, that they're derivative of the Martens Clause, that when the Martens Clause spoke to situations where the inhabitants of the nation are not protected by the treaty, they remain under the protection of dictators of humanity and public conscience. You can pigeonhole it here. You can pigeonhole it under just custom. However you get to it, they have to be non-heritage. Because I believe they form the foundation of a professional discipline and a special disciplined armed force that can engage in this brutality and come out of it with its sense of right and wrong intact. And I'll just close by reading you this quote. I'm teaching a criminal procedure right now at South Texas, and it's been a long time since I've gone and looked at these cases. But one of the cases I was reading was Massey, Ohio. Many of you probably remember that, and will remember it more as you study for your bar. Massey, Ohio dealt with the 14th Amendment of the Constitution and whether it was applicable to the state has nothing to do with the law of war. But the court used this quote in addressing, in supporting the conclusion that due process derived from the Constitution must apply to the state. Nothing can destroy a government more quickly than its failure to observe its own laws, or worse, its disregard for the charter of its own existence. In my opinion, the basic principles of the law of war are the charter of military own existence. And I support that sentence is deeply applicable. Nothing will destroy the professionalism and integrity of our force more quickly than disregarding the charter for our own. So that's the discussion. Now I'm going to do a radical change here and talk to you about the theory I have regarding civilians on the battlefield. As many of you may know, well, first some context. Civilians have always been part of military operations. Sutlers, camp followers, yes. Sure.
Before you get to the technical, I actually had a question.
Sure.
Regarding
that teacher. Well, I mean, I've written a few commentaries on this sort of thing. When I go back and read them, I think maybe a little bit too critical. I think that first up, let's accept one reality. The military works for civilian control. We have to accept that. As a consequence of that, our system of civilian control of the military presumes that civilians are going to be have a dominant role in this process. And so we get into, and that's a common issue that comes up now, because obviously we have Professor Yu writing his analysis of where, when and where laws were applied, and Mr. Bybee, and so on and so forth. In my opinion, the problem, or not the problem, the what sets the condition for kind of disregarding this aspect of the benefit of compliance was not so much a lack of understanding of the interests of the military, because there's no question that those concerns were expressed in these individuals. It was, in my opinion, the fact that we, the international law community itself, had turned this into a purely legal issue. It was an issue of statutory and treaty interpretation. And we have been proponents of that for years. That's what I'm saying. We focus, what does Article 2 say? What does Article 3 say? Like, what's the commentary? It's the JAG School. You can go back. You look at all the outlines from the instruction. It's purely legalistic. And then we had the International Tribunal, the U.S. Cottage decision, and the, you know, this monumental decision of what's the focus? What does Article 2 mean? What does Article 3 mean? How do we think? And I'm not saying that's not important. It's obviously important. But it seems to me that over the past 10 or 20 years, that's become disconnected from the underlying purpose of the law itself. And so what happened was we got to a point where lawyers, without any pragmatic understanding of the consequences of the decisions that were being issued, conceived. I mean, that's a presumption. I don't know. I've never talked to them, so I don't know what their... They may very well be concerned about that, but decided that it was not a significant concern. But for whatever reason, if you read those memos, if they are legal memos. And so the question becomes, look, this is called the law of war. It's not just war. It also involves war. That was my reaction to it. And so re-emphasizing the true Brundt norm or underlying purpose of this law, where it came from. This law did not originate with lawyers. Okay, let's be fair here. Who is dominant now in deciding what the law means, making sure the law evolves effectively, and analyzing how the law should be applied to military operations? Who is the dominant kind of group in that process? It's lawyers. We know that. Lawyers are significant in the treaty development process, and lawyers are principal legal advisors to military operations, et cetera, et cetera. But it's interesting to step back and say, wait a minute, this law didn't start before. This law evolved from military leaders who understood the pragmatic consequence of what's the benefit of a conceptionist rule and what's the negative side of a conceptionist rule. And they struck this down. So my concern in response to the issue you raised is that you don't have the robust involvement of that constituency. You set the conditions for the balance being distorted. Okay? And that raises a lot of issues in and of itself. I mean, one of the interesting aspects of this whole kind of after-action review that's been going on over the post 9/11 legal policy related to the treatment of Al Qaeda and Taliban detainees has been this kind of the praise that's been thrown on the senior uniformed military lawyers, the judge has suggested. Because now it's coming out that they were behind the scenes. It was pretty clear that they were saying they were very troubled by this, were rejected this. You see what Alberto Mora did. But I'll leave it at this point. That raises a concern in and of itself. Because we know that the law of war requires any officer, any military officer who believes that in order to receive is illegal, to refuse those. So how do you reconcile expressing tremendous concern over the improper or the unjustified conclusions being derived from legal advice, and then saying, well, now that we've expressed our concern and been told this is the way it's going to be, we're going to move on. There's only one of two possible inferences you can draw from that, in my mind. One is that there was a wholesale abdication of professional responsibility by the Uniform Legal Bar, and I reject that categorically. I don't think that's what happened. The other is, these were issues of such, in general, of such uncertainty that it was difficult for any of them to say, this is patently illegal. This is an interpretation that we have to listen to. Now, you know, I've been at conferences where I've had other professors say, you're from another planet. How can you say this is not patently illegal? Well, I mean, context is significant, interpretation. I do believe, however, that your concern is important. There has to be some structural mechanism in the process to ensure that the concerns of the constituents who are going to have to listen to these decisions are getting proper consideration. And I'm not sure that that construct exists. And so what, you have two responses that are potentially available. You have the McCain Amendment response, which is we'll legislate the stance, right? But see, my reaction to that is we had a legislation. I was listening to somebody on, I love listening to this morning's call-in on C-SPAN. Yesterday, we were talking a little bit about Congress, and someone called in and said, you know, one of the speakers said, well, you know, we need better rules, needs to be written, and someone told us, didn't we have this? Isn't that what the Geneva Convention told us? So what's the lesson? You can write as much as you want. If there's an effort to evade it, that's what lawyers do. I have a friend who's a very prominent professor in the corporate compliance field, and he and I have talked about this. And in the corporate compliance realm, what the proponents of ethical corporate compliance realize, it's more about the structure of the procedural mechanism than it is about the tool itself. You have to ensure that there are structural mechanisms in place within the organization to guard against this type of violation. So to close on your question, I'll leave you with this question. Consider this. The General Counsel of the Department of Defense is, I think, a three-star, the senior civilian lawyer in the military, politically appointed, Mr. Haynes, works directly with the Secretary of Defense. In the operational chain of command, you have the Secretary of Defense, who is in the National Command Authority. His lawyer is a three-star person. His operational counterpart is the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. His lawyer is a partner, or an OSA. Why? Is that procedural equity? Are we satisfied that a uniformed lawyer at the top of the operational chain of command has the same clout as the non-uniformed lawyer, the politically appointed lawyer? I don't think so. So one of the questions I think somebody should be asking is why? Why aren't the uniformed lawyers given more? And in that world, we know that rank matters. Why don't they have more power to live in the government? And I think one of the answers is because up until 9/11, that was never the case. I don't know if I answered your question. That's the question.
Right. Sure.
I don't think it's always a bad. I think, as a matter of fact, I think the McCain Amendment, with the modifications that was agreed to in the compromise, if anything, has elevated the significance of a robust, uniform presence in that decision-making process. Because the McCain Amendment, as I read it, compromise provision, essentially says that if I'm a subordinate JAG officer, if I'm down in Kabul or Tikrit or wherever, and I receive a policy from DOD, and I know that policy has been vetted by lawyers at that level, I'm supposed to almost conclusively presume that it's legal. And my commander says, if I follow this, could I get in trouble? And my answer has to be no. Because the amendment says, as long as it's been reviewed by lawyers at a higher level, you have top cover. So, to me, if anything, that says, you better make sure that kind of sausage-making process at that high level is effective and has robust involvement of uniform service. The reason I don't think it's inevitable is because I think the military commanders now, more than ever, have come to realize that they need those legal advisors to help them sort through some of these issues, particularly when they're being pushed harder and harder by, let's just say, higher, to go in certain directions. Okay. Can I?
Yeah. Okay.
Civilians on the battlefield. Quick factual summary. Anybody ever hear the phrase tooth-to-tail ratio? Well, it's not a okay. Tooth-to-tail ratio essentially refers to the effort of the Department of Defense to maximize the ability to use uniformed personnel for combat-type functions by minimizing the requirement to use them for support-type functions. You increase the ratio of your tooth-to-tail. As a result, over the past kind of maybe 15 years, as we have seen, there has been a huge explosion in the number of civilians who are contracted by DOD to provide all sorts of functions in relation to military operations. This first became apparent in the Balkans, in operations in Bosnia and Kosovo, where almost the entire sustainment effort was contingent on contract support, primarily ground and troops. Okay, then we get to Iraq, and now in Afghanistan, and this trend continues. In my mind, one of the significant legal issues related to contemporary military operations that has not garnered a lot of attention is how do we decide the limits of the activities that those civilians may be involved in. Historically, the criteria that's been applied has been direct participation standard that comes out of Protocol 1. The principle that says that only combatants are supposed to directly participate in hostilities. And if civilians take direct part in hostilities, they lose their immunity from attack. Well, logically, I mean, if you're on a battlefield, civilians and stuff, the last 12 rifle endpoint for that, if you're a soldier, you're going to protect yourself and your force. That civilian, through that direct participation in the fight, has lost the immunity from attack. And so, traditionally, DOD has relied on this standard, or this criteria, to say, we can use civilians to perform any function that does not cross the line into direct participation. Now, the problem with that, from my perspective, is first, that no one's really sure where that line is. What is direct participation? You can read articles on this, you can get debates, that's some of you had Hayes Park as your professor. Is driving the ammo on the battlefield direct participation? Because if you don't have the ammo, then troops can't fight. So the enemy, well, you're making a direct contribution to war effort. Well, but then wait a minute. Is the guy 6,000 miles away in the ammo factory directly participating in hostilities? Because if he weren't working, if you could kill him, then the ammo wouldn't get to the driver, it wouldn't get to the force. Or is it much more restrictive? Is it because is it when the driver gets out of the vehicle and actually picks up the weapon and aims it? Okay. So drawing that line is very difficult. And I'll give you one example. Take the issue of a predator on an unmanned aerial vehicle, an armed unmanned aerial vehicle. Okay. Does the direct participation standard permit the United States to hire a contractor to launch that vehicle and recover? Can he fly to the designated target? Can he use the sight, the camera, to place crosshairs on the target? And can he pull the engagement mechanism, fire the Hellfire missile? I mean, you see different levels where some might say, well, just launching is direct participation. Well, maybe not. Maybe you have to get further down the road. So that one problem with the direct participation standard is that I think it's difficult to define. The other problem with it, as we've learned, particularly from Hobbs & Gray, is that it doesn't really address the core issue, which is who should be allowed to engage in activity on the battlefield that is traditionally what we might call uniform. Because you can have the most precise definition of direct participation in the world, it doesn't give you any help when somebody says we're going to contract interrogators. These civilians who we just hired are going to do the interrogation. Or we're going to contract a logistics officer who's going to run the prisoner of war. He'll be the one who decides what rations these prisoners are worth in an Article 2 fund. And so, what I'm trying to propose is what I call right now, and I don't know if I'm going to say this way, but I call it the war crimes test, or the war crimes test. When you look at the direct participation standard, one of the problems with it that jumps out is that direct participation is not a standard that is related to status. It's a standard that's related to targeting. It's in the provisions of Protocol 1, Official Protocol 1, that protects the civilian population from the harmful effects of weapons. And so you can look at that and say, well, that is the criteria that we use to decide who can be shot at lawfully. It's not the criteria that tells us who we can put on the battlefield lawfully to do a certain function. In my mind, the answer to that comes from an interrelationship between the Article 4 criteria for prisoner of war status in the Third Convention and the doctrine of command responsibility. In Article 4, we know that if the United States authorizes a civilian contractor to be on the battlefield, that civilian contractor is entitled to prisoner of war status upon capture. But that civilian is entitled to that status even though there's no express requirement that the civilian wear a uniform, carry arms openly, obey the law of war, and operate under responsible command. The other type of civilian that gets prisoner of war status upon capture is a member of a militia corps or volunteer corps. But for that civilian to get prisoner of war status, that civilian has to follow those four criteria, which we know are so significant to the United States because it's been the basis for denying Taliban detainees prisoner of war status. I think what that tells us is that the concept of civilians on the battlefield, or civilians who are authorized to be on the battlefield, anticipated that they not be able to engage in activities that are normally associated with warriors. Now, how do you figure that out? I mean, I don't think that's too controversial. And proponents of the direct participation standards would say, well, that's exactly what our standard says. Warriors are allowed to take direct part in hostilities, civilians aren't. I think what it really reflects is that, and this is why I think command responsibility is connected here. This is where this started I thought about when the allegations of prisoner abuse came out of Abu Ghraib, and it was, and we learned that some of the interrogators that might have been abusing prisoners and detainees were contractors. I thought about this strange disparity between command authority and command responsibility. Because under the doctrine of command responsibility, the commander of that prison ostensibly would be vicariously liable for misconduct of the contractor. And yet, prior to the misconduct, that commander did not have the ability to subject that contractor to the internal disciplinary code associated with the armed forces. So, and I think that disparity needs to be recognized. And so where that led me was to this war crimes test. Essentially, I believe the test for determining when a civilian, what a civilian can do in support of the armed forces is to ask, when exercising the discretion associated with that function, is there a genuine possibility of a violation of the law of armed forces? If the answer is yes, it must be reserved to uniformed members of the force. If the answer is no, a civilian can perform the function. Now, why do I think this is a better step? First off, I think it is broad enough to address every aspect of the military operation. The shooting, the interrogation, the feeding of prisoners of war, the provision of medical care, the provision of religious services to prisoners of war. You can go down. That's one. The other reason I think that it's more valuable is because we know that under DOD policy, DOD policy doesn't establish a standard. It simply says subordinate operational commanders, you must ensure that your use of civilians on the battlefield is consistent with international law and other binding law and policy. So when the operational commander has this huge budget for contracts and a finite number of uniformed leadership, that commander is going to go to the legal advisor and say, I want a contract for interrogators. I can do it. The contracting officer says we've got the money, we got the, you know, we got the motive, means, and opportunity. All right? We got it. So can I do it? Is it legal? Now, under the current standard, what's the lawyer going to say? Well, I have to decide if that's correct participation. Even if it's not the contractor, let's say it's the UAV operator. Having a lawyer, and with all due respect to my former and future military legal advisors, lawyers are not experts in the concept of military operations. You're asking a lawyer to make a decision based on a criteria they're not necessarily familiar with. What is or is not direct participation? Now change that. Now the commander comes and says, I want to use interrogators, contract interrogators at Abu Ghraib. I need you to assess this to determine whether you think when they perform that function, there's potential that they might violate law. That's what lawyers do every day. That's what we're trained to do. It's more, it facilitates the role of the legal advisor in aiding in this judgment. Now, when I first talked about this, one of the critics said, well, look, anybody on the battlefield can just commit a law for a violation. A cook can pick up a rifle and murder someone, and that's a war crime. Or can go out and rape a civilian, that's a war crime. Now, I understand that. When I use the term war crimes test, what I'm talking about are violations of the laws and customs of war, inhumane treatment, targeting somebody who's not a lawful objective, violating specific provisions of the convention relating to the treatment of prisoners of war. I'm not talking about the crime in war. I'm talking about the type of conduct that normally would be covered by the immunity of the law of war that is not because the circumstances don't justify it. The other aspect is that the focus is on the function and the discretionary execution of the function, not on some some potential conduct that has nothing to do with that function. And so you can look at a couple of hypotheticals. We can go back to the one that starts the interrogator. If you were a lawyer working for DOD or working for CENTCOM, and someone came to you and said, if in the process of interrogation, is there a good, if discretion is abused, is there a good possibility of war crime may occur? What do you think? As a result of abuse of discretion? No? Yes? Maybe. I mean, how does an interrogator abuse discretion? He starts beating the subject. When an interrogator uses physical abuse against the object of interrogation, is that a war crime? I think so. How about the translator? What's the function of a translator? Did he say there or then? So the discretion vested in the translator is to say, no, I know what that word means. It's then, not there. What's the probability that in the exercise of that function, a war crime will occur? De minimis. Okay? Or how about a cook? What discretion does a cook have? Well, we need more salt. We need a little more pepper. Right? Is that cook going to commit a war crime? Is there any reasonable probability that exercising that discretion a war crime will occur? No. But if you're the logistics officer deciding to menu for prisoners of war, and you have a prisoner of war facility full of Muslim prisoners, and you pick up the phone back to your supply depot and say, send me all the pork patties you can find, you're going to be responsible for the commission of a war crime. We know that. And you can take the example of the UAV, Predator. If you hire a civilian to launch and recover that piece of equipment, what is the discretion associated with launching and recovering? Well, I don't know, I don't fly those things. Lift the flaps, lower the flaps. What's the probability of a war crime being committed through the exercise of that discretion? It's de minimis. But now it comes time to engage targets, to select the engaged target. If discretion is abused in that function, the risk of a war crime is through the roof. And so what does that tell you? You can hire the civilian to launch a recovery, but a uniformed person has to be the one to make the target selection and engage the roof. And you can keep going down the list. That's why I think it's a more effective standard. But fundamentally, I think it reconciles command authority and command responsibility.
What if the contract is just
Right. And that, and again, I'm not suggesting that the test is it possible that this civilian might commit a war crime? Every civilian on the battlefield, a journalist can commit a war crime. Right? That's why it's the decision of what is a permissible use of the individual. Right? And so that's why I think the focus has to be on the discretionary execution of responsibility of that task. Okay? Of that task or function. And not the potential that they'll stray out of it. Because it is the task itself that we have to be concerned with in determining whether the authority we're giving the civilian is a prima facie violation of the obligation to reserve certain functions on the battlefield to members of the uniformed force. Individuals who are subject to internal disciplinary code. Because if you go beyond that, the whole thing crumbles. But so does direct participation. Because I can say, well, a truck driver doesn't directly participate in hostility. What if he stops the truck, picks up rifle, and starts shooting? I mean, it's impossible for anybody under any standard. Oh, certainly. I mean, if that civilian contractor who's hired to cook decides he's going to go be an assistant interrogator, you know, then you've got an issue of criminal responsibility. And this is another important point about the standard. My focus is not, and this is why I'm struggling with the title. I don't like the war crimes test because that suggests that folks is criminal responsibility. It's not criminal responsibility. It's my belief that the United States has a prima facie obligation to respect the law of war by ensuring that only the right people are allowed to do the right function, whether or not the enemy ever sees them, or whether or not anybody ever even finds out about whether they abuse their discretion. When I'm asked by a commander, am I allowed to use a civilian to do this, I have to tell him something that's in compliance with law, regardless of the consequences. And that's why I think this would be a better criteria and a more effective criteria than the direct participation. Yes.
I was just thinking, how problematic would it be for a
yep. Private security
contract. We have all the contracts.
Well, I think... Right. I think the... Well, first of all, I think that's a little bit overstated. I think there's more accountability than media has suggested. But I understand, there's one of the most difficult contract issues in the war in Iraq has been the role of private security contracts. And again, why? Because you have limited uniform resources, and also there's a concern that you've got civilian contracts that make you reducing your uniform footprint, which is good for, you know, the perception that we're moving away from being the occupiers and the supporters. Another benefit of standardizing is that it flexes with the nature of the operations. If you're in the midst of a high-intensity Article 2 international armed conflict, if you use a private security contractor for anything, the risk that that individual is going to confront a member of the enemy armed forces and be tempted to participate in the conflict is very high. And so the answer would be, no, can't do it because, and I don't know, maybe, and I'm just thinking, how do you come up with, do you have like a number system or a red, green, yellow system? You know, that's definitely a yellow, probably a red. It's certainly not a green. But as the nature of the operation winds down, and you're no longer confronting an enemy that's privileged to be fighting you, now you're confronting criminals, you know, rogue elements. And any person under the domestic law of the state that has the authority to act in self-defense at the expense of others, you could say that the risk of a war crime has dropped substantially just by the change in the nature of the operation. And so maybe the answer is, at the initial phase of the operation, no private security contract. But as you move into a post-conflict stability phase, then there's much more room for them, and then it may depend on where they're used. Are you going to use them to guard a military base? Probably not. Are you going to use them to guard a humanitarian relief convoy? Probably yes. The other value of that kind of situational flexibility is it's also useful when you look at peacekeeping operations. Could you have a war crime violation in Bosnia or Kosovo? You know, that's a difficult technical issue. If you're going to confront your rogue elements to defeat them to the application of military force, you might not necessarily be in an armed conflict. And again, under my theory, you'd be bound to comply with the basic principles of the war. But even with that remote contingency, or because that's a remote contingency, a far more robust use of contractors would probably be justified because of the nature of the operation itself. I don't know for sure. I don't know if the contract itself or if it was created some type of status of forces coverage for them because they were associated with the armed forces. I don't know the answer to that. Well, there, you know, the complexity is that it's when the occupation ended and you had the UN resolution, and then you have the argument that they're operating under the authority of the model UN status agreement. I don't know, Sam, do you know? No, under the CPA original order. And I don't know, I would presume, and it's just a presumption, that those private security contracts were put under the umbrella of whatever immunity applied to U.S. forces, but I'm not positive. Yeah. Well, I'll start with the last part of the question first. The Uniform Code of Military Justice is the internal kind of criminal code for the uniform. It's a statute passed by Congress pursuant to their authority under Article 1 of the Constitution to regulate land and naval forces. It actually has a provision extending jurisdiction to civilians accompanying the force in case of declared, which was the result of the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces opinions out of the Vietnam War. There was a case called Averett in the Vietnam conflict where the military court-martialed a contractor for abusing, I think for murder, and it was overturned on the theory that this provision of UCMJ extending jurisdiction is very limited. Now, Congress has never changed that. Whether or not Congress could, well, Congress certainly could, whether or not it would be deemed constitutional is uncertain. My personal opinion is that it would be uphill. That unique relationship of the civilian who chooses to go to work for the military in that environment results in the acceptability of extending this jurisdiction. And the other case that was significant in analyzing the ability of the military to try civilians was the case that came out of England, where the Supreme Court ruled that trying a civilian spouse for murder violated the Constitution because the civilian spouse was not entitled to the normal procedural guarantees afforded to the criminal defendants in the United States. But in that case, the Supreme Court and the name is escaping me. No, the name is escaping me. But in that case, if you read that opinion carefully, the Supreme Court said, talking about the specific issue of a civilian spouse who's with the military only because her husband was assigned to this location. We're not giving this positive treatment on the other reasonable justifications that the government may have for subjecting civilians to military authority. It really is an interesting dilemma. And by the way, Iraq is not the first place that we confronted this. I mean, when I was in Europe as chief of international law before the war, occasionally a contractor in Kosovo or Bosnia would do something that would be, say, felony-type conduct in this country. And we face, the commander faced a huge dilemma. Do you turn this individual over to a judicial system that is, you have, let's just say, at this point in time, we're not confident he's operating consistently with the basic concepts that we associate with fair trial and due process of justice? Or do we just fire him and send him home? Because, or do we engage DOJ and ask DOJ to get motivated in wanting to bring one of these cases? I think political will is the key issue with under the current construct. NEJA, which, as most of you know, refers to the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act, is really kind of a misnomer. It's not the Military Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act. It's the Civilian Extraterritorial Jurisdiction Act if you happen to be working in the military. The military is already subject to extraterritorial jurisdiction in the form of the UCMJ. And NEJA was written and implemented specifically to give military commanders the opportunity to go to DOJ and say, we want you to do it. There have not been many cases that have been initiated by the NEJA. I know when I was in Europe, there was one that came out of Turkey. I don't know what ever happened to it. It's an Air Force base. And I think there's one ongoing in North Carolina for one of the interrogators. I don't know what the status of that case is. The War Crimes Act is another statute that, to my knowledge, has not been used to hold anybody accountable. And obviously, I think NEJA is a better, you know, pragmatically is a better approach because you don't have to worry about the jurisdictional challenge of proving this was a war crime. If you get it under NEJA, you don't have to prove you're in the right type of armed conflict, the person was, you don't have to do any of that. I think the mechanism exists. Personally, I think many military commanders would not mind. Well, let me rephrase. My opinion is, I doubt any military commanders would be troubled by having the ability to subject a contractor to a court-martial for misconduct associated with the military operation. And in fact, that's part of the kind of, that was the factor that motivated my thinking on this different approach to what civilians are allowed to do. Because military commanders can't do that, because as you probably know, all a military commander can do is go to the JAG and say, would you contact DOJ and please try and get them to get motivated to deal with this mystery? Okay, because if this person were, if it weren't the contract interrogator, but were the uniformed interrogator next to him, that person would be on trial under my authority. And so in my mind, because the commander does not have the power to subject those civilians to that internal disciplinary code, it's a compelling reason why those civilians should not be able to perform any function where imputed liability will be projected back to the commander under the doctrine of command responsibility. It's fundamentally inequitable. Yeah. Right. I think sending the UCMJ to any civilian who is associated with the military operation would have benefits. It would also have immense challenges. It would increase the number of cases that the military would be responsible for. And if you were the civilian, who went to a... Look, I come from Houston. I drive to the airport. I drive right by Kellogg or Halliburton Headquarters. And every couple of months, you see in the Houston Chronicle a job fair. You know, come to the Houston Marriott and, you know, look how you can make $100,000 a year driving a truck. Yeah, okay, so 100 people come and then you find out in threat. Okay, but if you go to the airport, you see many of them heading off, right? Now, how many of them expect, as part of that bargain, that they're going to get some uniformed lawyer sitting next to them in a court with military members sitting in judgment of them with no grand jury, no indictment, no jury of their peers, no other contractors on the jury, just military guys? I mean, there are huge kind of fundamental constitutional questions associated with subjecting civilians to military authority. I think that MEJA represents for all of us the collective conclusion of DOD, DOJ, the executive branch, and Congress that it is not a good idea to try and meddle with UCMJ to subject these civilians to military court. Why? Because not necessarily because we could conceivably change the code to do it, but because it raises too many fundamental concerns about the justice they should get it. So let's create a law that enables the Department of Justice to hold these individuals accountable for their misconduct in the same type of process that any other federal criminal defendant would be entitled to. Politically, is there will to do it? I mean, I don't know. Gavin. Okay. Right. I think MEJA incorporates a number of federal offenses. It doesn't specify what violates MEJA. It has kind of an assimilated crimes approach, but it doesn't assimilate the crimes of the state with the contract entails, from where the contract entails. My brother is a line attorney in the criminal division of DOJ.
We probably have time for one more question in class, if you could. So maybe one more.
Yeah. If it was an American contractor working in that environment, I'd have to go back and look. I think conceptually MEJA would extend to it. Certainly the work contractor is under them. And then of course you'd have, depending on the nature of the offense, you'd have other states with private search jurisdiction under universal jurisdiction doctrine. If they're expert on mission, there's a certain immunity issue. But I think the immunity, I believe, can be waived by the Secretary of Defense.
Very interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I hope that I didn't disappoint you because I didn't devote. I mean, to me, the first issue of accountability is making sure that contractors are not submitted to perform function that they shouldn't perform. That, to me, is the current dilemma, because DOD is going to continue to push to maximize the role of civilians. Why? Which is an easy, this is my, again, my opinion, which is an easier resource to expend? Money or going back to Congress and saying we need to increase the size of the force? Eventually, you're going to run out of well, eventually you might. Eventually you might run out of volunteers. And I don't think it's insignificant to remember. This is the first sustained war that this nation has ever fought in all volunteer force. Nobody has been conscripted to fight in this war. Well, not the reserves, not conscription in the sense of, right? And so do we think that there's any probability that the emphasis on using, maximizing civilian contract support is going to be diminished in the near term? I don't think so. So that's why my focus was the first line of accountability, which is ensure that only the people who have an expectation of compliance with the law of armed conflict because of training, internal disciplinary code, and command authority are permitted to perform those functions that pose a serious risk to violence.
Help me thank Jeffrey.
I don't know if it's standard on that.
No, I like it. Here's Jeff.